had a passion but no plan.
I know it sounds bizarre, but we probably went from kind of 1 million to 15 million quite easily, and it made me look weak. Which, as you know, Phil, is probably the last thing you want to do as a leader, is look weak. How do you go from being, you know, an entrepreneurial business where the senior leadership team are all shareholders in the company, you know, to being part of a larger organisation where they're not?
This is the Leeds Business Podcast, and I'm your host, Phil Fraser. I'm a business sounding board. Think somewhere between a business coach and a business mentor. If you're a business owner feeling lonely at the top, drop me an email. I can help you. In this week's episode, we speak to Alistair Maiden, founder of legal tech company, Psyche. Hear business tales and learnings from the legendary Ken Morrison, Alistair's eureka moment for the business, how the business grew to an eventual multi-million pound sale in the US, and the subsequent hard changes that needed to take place after sale. Plus, what's it like buying an abattoir? I have one simple request before we get into this week's episode. Please hit the follow or subscribe button on the app that you're listening on. That's it. Thank you. So, let's get into what is a fascinating story. Today's guest on the show is Alistair Maiden, founder of probably one of Leeds's, I don't know, hidden gems, Psyche. Good morning, Alistair.
Morning.
Before we start, just very, very simply, and I know this might be difficult as well, explain what Psyche do.
Yeah, it's not always that straightforward. So we're a legal operations and technology consultancy. So what that means in practice is we help corporate legal teams from some of the world's biggest companies like HSBC, Google, Meta, to think about how they can use technology to improve their legal processes. And then once we've gone through that thinking process, we help them actually implement the technology. And that could be technology relating to contracting. It could be how they manage their litigation. It could be how they manage all of their external legal spend. And we tend to have very long relationships with those customers. So if you take Unilever as one example, we've been working with them for 8 years, and we'll probably be working with them for another 8 years, because what increasingly technology is just becoming absolutely integral to the way that a corporate legal team operates.
Okay, hopefully the more simplistic of us understand what you do. So let's go back a bit, and you started life as a lawyer. Give us a very quick run through as to how you got to Asda, because that's sort of where the story really starts.
Yeah, see, I guess I was a normal lawyer, qualified at McCormick's, which was a Leeds-based practice specialising in sports law, then had a kind of ill-fated stint at Cool Credit, which is now TransUnion, went in-house for a bit. That didn't work out. I then went to Gordon's, which is a great Yorkshire law firm, learned how to be a lawyer from a chap called Peter Barton. He was a partner and had a commercial there at the time. He was a great mentor to me, and I developed quickly and then got sent out on secondment to Gordon's biggest client, Morrison's. I think I did a reasonable job there, and so I stayed on secondment for a very long period of time. I think it was about 3 years. Basically that transferred to being my day-to-day office. I managed to get a pass to the car park, which for anyone who's visited Hillmore House is not easy. And then following that, got headhunted to join Asda's legal team. Initially I was a contracts lawyer, and I worked my way through to being their data protection officer and also head of transactions throughout the whole business. So, but a fairly standard legal career until I launched Psyche.
Just out of interest, is being seconded into a client, sort of like being the lawyer firm's man on the ground, is that a normal thing? Is that normal in legal terms?
Yeah, a little bit. It's quite normal to get seconded into a client, but I was still relatively junior at that stage, so I would, right. you know, I wouldn't want to overstate my importance.
Right.
Although, you know, being a sensible commercial chap, I obviously exploited the fact that I was on the grounds as much as possible. Okay. And made myself as important as possible. So I recognize that I've been given an amazing opportunity.
Sorry, carry on. Cut across you there.
Yeah, just to interface with that. I mean, I had some amazing experiences because when I was there, Sir Ken was still at the helm in the business. And I was sitting near his office. So had a lot of opportunity to interface with him and Sarain Gibson as well. Mark Bolland was the CEO at the time, and Dalton came on board after that. So it was a great learning experience at a relatively junior phase of my career.
So what was Sir Ken Morrison like? I mean, I've heard various tales about him.
He was funny, and I used to work very late at that time. You know, I was forever beavering away in the office, and Morrison's was actually way ahead of its time in that it was embracing sustainability in a head office way back, and we're talking about, I guess we're probably talking 10-15 years ago now at least, and so they had a system in the office whereby if there was no activity under the lights would go off. I'm working in the office one evening, late at night, probably about 10 at night, trying to complete a transaction. And I suddenly see it was a little bit like The Shining, is these lights coming towards me. They're like switching on, coming towards me. And it was Sir Ken. And he was going around the office, finding people who, finding computers that had been left on, and writing post-it note onto the computer saying, please don't leave your computer on again, Sir Ken. Which I feel was just really summed the guy up. Really summed the guy. And I that actually has had a really lasting impact on me now I'm running my own business, because, you know, I think you get so much respect from being in the detail, in the real detail. And the fact that you still know what's going on, it surprises people, but I think it also keeps them honest.
So you go around putting post-it notes on your team's computer saying, turn this off.
I do the modern digital approach. There's some interesting culture. I used to do a lot of the agency contracts at Morrison's, and I do remember one of the strategies as well that they used from a negotiation perspective, which I found fascinating, was you'd go in and you'd have the pitch or the contract negotiation if it was a little bit further down the line, and at a certain point a tea lady would come into the room and serve everyone tea and biscuits. What do you want? Oh, I'll have a can of pop and I'll have a cake and blah blah blah. And then and this always used to really throw everyone, is then the Morrison's buyer would actually make the agency pay the tea lady for the tea. And it was just a power play. Like, you wouldn't believe, you know, suddenly the whole tenor of the meeting changed. And it was fascinating. It was fascinating to watch that. So great place that, you know, obviously as a lawyer, you're, people think of being into, you know, words and going to court and wearing a silly wig and dispute. But actually, what I was doing was helping, I guess, smooth the wheels of multi-million pound deals for bananas and champagne and lorries. And I remember spending a lot of time over a cheese slicing machine, and then also help. I was privileged to help them at a time where they were, Morrison's a great business with the integrated supply chain where it owns the, you know, I think it still owns the farms, the fish processing plants, the, you know, literally the cows that you, and I still actually shop, I buy my meat from there still because I still rate it, and I know where it's come from, which is important to me. I was lucky enough to be helping them buy some of those businesses at the time. mostly good fun. I have to admit, buying the abattoir was less fun. So it was pretty grisly experience for me when I went there, but really interesting. So real privilege to cut my teeth learning about proper business, I guess, rather than just focusing on words and disputes.
So let's just go forward then. So you went from Morrison's to Asda, and it was, give us a brief idea of what you were doing at Asda, and then when this sort of light bulb moment occurred.
See, more of the same at Asda, really, but there's a big distinction. Asda had and probably still has an absolutely unique culture that's quite different from, and I think it probably stems back from the Archie Norman, Alan Layton days, and I didn't cross over with them, but really distinct culture. And it's actually fascinating to track back through the number of successful Leeds business people who have cut their teeth at Asda and been through that process. I mean, loads of people that I used to work with are running their own successful businesses. And I think it's a couple of things. It's the, I think it was just a really flat, open culture where you had to persuade people to do everything. So it wasn't the case that you could just say, I'm a director and therefore you have to do what I say. Even the job titles were complex, so you could never really work out whether someone was senior or junior to you. And then, you know, you'd always have to persuade them. So that art of persuasion comes really important. And, it was a critical part of my education. I'm not really answering the question, but...
No, this is great. This is great stuff. This is great. Carry on.
And the other thing that Asda that's different or was different was that we were part of Walmart. So part of the biggest, at the time, we were part of the biggest company in the world, 2.1 million colleagues worldwide, a turnover in excess of the GDP of Argentina. So I'm suddenly in this business with a global scale. And I was really lucky, actually, early in my career, Asda, to be given the opportunity to fly over to Bentonville, Arkansas, which really felt like that's the headquarters of Walmart. It felt like the seat of power of this huge company. I worked on a tech project implementation for Walmart as the lead lawyer. And then I also got exposure to go over to Silicon Valley, to San Bruno and Sunnyvale, and work on some projects. And specifically focused around innovation and how we could patent certain ideas for digital grocery shopping that were, it was a bit of an arms race at the time. It's become normalized now, but back then it was a bit of a crucible of innovation. The international aspect, because hitherto I'd only really worked in Yorkshire, plus the scale, plus, you know, just being in and around all of this innovation, just, you know, sparked my mind. And I was like, wow, you know, this, like, I'm no longer content to work in, you know, I like Leeds, but it broadened my horizon. And there's a whole world out there of opportunity. And, I'd be mad to constrain myself to... because I always think that I love Leeds. It's like a village, the corporate community. You're like 1 degree separate from anyone. A couple of people I do business with text me last night saying, I hear you're on with Phil tomorrow, just as an idea.
Already?
Yeah. I don't mean to diminish that, but it's more about, it just really opened my eyes to that. Like, why can't I work globally, that's been a key part of what followed, really.
And all of that then feeds into
the birth of the idea of psych. So just talk us through that bit.
Yeah, see, despite everything we said, I was still at the point that psych was launched. It wasn't even called psych then; it was called A Maiden Limited. But at that point, I'm still a lawyer, not a business guy. And so what really happened was we did our own internal digitization process in the Alistair legal team. And I totally fell in love with this concept that legal is difficult and actually there's a better way through improving the holistic processes and then digitizing them. That's conceptually, we proved that point at Asda. So we reduced the average contract cycle, which is the time from when someone says, I need a contract, to the time it's signed. We reduced that from 70 days to 5 days by digitizing and improving the process. And so once I'd proven that and I was like, wow, this could be seriously impactful. I then started to go and talk to people about the subject. There were a couple of people. There's a guy called Rich Newton who was owning the software company I was working with. He was encouraging me to think about, okay, maybe you could do this as a profession. And then I went and went down to the Law Society in London. I was invited. And I remember this chat from the Law Society, and it's a very traditional environment, that, as you can imagine.
Right.
And the chap saying, look, I'd like to come and speak, but just to warn you, like, there's normally like 10 or 15 people turn up and it's the same people every time. And, maybe you'll get something out of it, but I just want to manage your expectations. So I turn up at the Law Society. I'd never publicly spoken about the subject before. And I walk in to the auditorium, expecting 10 people, and there were like 100 people sitting down and another 100 people standing at the back. And that was really the light bulb moment where I was like, gosh, people are actually interested in it. Lawyers are interested in how they can improve and how they can digitize. And I remember I gave a 20-minute presentation. And then there was an hour of questions afterwards. And so that, that evening I was absolutely buzzing. And funnily enough, because I'd spent the day doing that, I actually had to wake up at 3:30 in the morning and do a competition commission response on behalf of Asda the following day. And I just thought, that's it.
Well, hold that point there, because I'm going to come back onto it. Before I do, Lau, I just want to talk briefly to everybody about the Leeds Business Podcast Fair Deal. The Leeds Business Podcast Fair Deal has two sides to it. My side to it is, for free, every week, I bring you inspirational, motivational, and fascinating guests like Alistair. Your side of the deal, listener and viewer, has two parts to it. Part number one, recommend this podcast to one other person who you feel will get benefit from it. And part number two, post us a review either at Apple Podcasts on their app, at podchaser.com, or give us a thumbs up on Spotify. So that was the light bulb moment, and you went, right, okay. And lots of entrepreneurs will recognize this. It's that point where you go, right, I'm going to do something. So what did you do? Did you walk in on Monday morning and go, right, I quit? Or how did it go from there?
I am a bit of a, it's funny. Most people would say I'm not, but from my perspective, I'm still a bit of a cautious Mary. What I did was just speak to a couple of people who were already in the industry and try and set up a little bit of work so that when I got started, I would at least, have enough money coming in to pay the mortgage, was basically the objective.
It's quite interesting, actually, when you start to do the maths on consultancy and you're being paid a day rate, you don't actually need to work that much to pay the mortgage. I guess it depends how big your mortgage is, but I probably, when I started the business, I would have thought I was probably doing about a day and a half of consultancy a week and 3.5 days of selling a week. And over the course of the first year, I mean, things started pretty slowly, but by the end of year one, I was probably selling 10 days of consultancy service a week and working 16-hour days and doing my selling on Saturdays and Sundays. Because there was a real interest in this. So the trick for me was probably the difficulty is how do you go from being, a one man expert trying to sell you to actually trying to sell a business. That took me at least a couple of years to get over.
How did that switch feel? Because obviously you've worked in, really large businesses with departments and PAs and execs and all that sort of thing. And then it must be a huge culture switch to then, as all startups know, you have to do everything. How did you cope with that?
Don't get me wrong, it was a challenge. But I think one of the interesting things about working in supermarkets is that if you think about, the IT team are extremely focused on keeping the lights on, keeping the tills working, keeping the distribution network going. The marketing team are super focused on the customer, and likewise the e-commerce team, people running shops. So believe me, the legal team were the last people on the list to receive any kind of help from anyone else in the business about anything. So it was already the case that I was pretty self-sufficient, certainly from an IT perspective. And also, I think I've probably mentioned this before, but just working in that supermarket environment, learned an enormous amount about business generally from some people who were, I think, at the top of their game. So it was probably easier than you might imagine. But don't get me wrong, I remember one day when my emails stopped working, and basically having a seismic meltdown. How do you fix this?
You didn't have an IT department to ring.
No.
From that point where you go, right, okay, I'm doing the consultancy, I'm doing the selling, we're looking at where we're 2016, 2017. When did it really sort of kick in and you thought, right, I really have got something here. This is a proper business. This has got legs. What was that change? Where did that happen?
It's an interesting question. I remember getting I went to a friend's 40th birthday weekend or week in Ibiza. And when I had a stinking hangover doing a call with the general counsel in London, and her saying, how would you feel about us engaging Psyche on a retainer, and it will be £20,000 a month at minimum commitment a year. I'm sitting there with my hangover thinking, this is actually quite a lot of money and probably more work than I could cover myself personally. So I'm going to have to hire some people to do this. And we began to, it's interesting because we've moved away from it now, actually, but we began to enter into these kind of retainer relationships where we'd sell a certain amount of time. And actually, looking at the book of work, we probably had, over £1 million work in kind of guaranteed contracts. And it's that point where you say, okay, well, I've now got a foundation here from which I can build. I've got security. I can employ people, I can engage people, I can plan. And I do think that And we probably went from, I know it sounds bizarre, but we probably went from kind of 1 million to 15 million quite easily. It was kind of getting to that 1 million was quite challenging. It's an exciting point.
This is what fires the enthusiasm of people who've got that entrepreneurial spirit. That's, you know, people who like having a job would be scared shitless, whereas the entrepreneur finds it, you know, hugely enthusing and fire in the belly and all that sort of thing. But so the business, obviously, you know, 1 to 15 million is quite a big step. 2019, Lawyers on Demand, how did that deal work and how was that structured and where did it come from?
Yes, I'm
thinking 2019 seems maybe
a bit early.
Sorry, 2021. Sorry, it's 2021. Sorry.
2021.
Yeah. So around that time, we were making, so I think people began to realize that certainly it's not a household name, but in the niche industry in which we work, I think everyone was aware of Scythe. And basically looking to acquire that capability and fold it into their main business. So we had a lot of interest from large law firms, from large consulting practices that you have probably heard of. And some other niche players, software providers, etc. So I think what they all wanted to do was to say, right, let's take the capability. By that stage, we probably had, I don't know, 50, 60 people. Let's take the capability. This is something new. It's growing. We'll just bring it into our business. We'll get rid of this silly Scythe brand. We'll have Alistair work for us for a couple of years. Spin him out. I wasn't really into that. Yeah, I'm 43 now. So back then, you know, just turned 40, and I was like, you know, I think this has got some legs left in it. And so the LAD deal was great because it enabled them to make an investment in the company, and we would operate as the same group. So a lot of our problems about scale and, you know, LAD is one of the leading brands in the alternative legal service provider market, so most customers will have heard. So a lot of the issues about brand recognition, scale, you know, even things like IT security, shared services, a lot of those issues, which do make it quite difficult as a business to scale well away. I retained control of the business from an operational perspective. So it enabled us really to concentrate on just selling and on growing the business as quickly as possible, so selling and delivering excellent quality service. And then I'd also cashed in some chips as well, so I was able to be less risk averse. So for example, we had a lot of pre-deal, we had a lot of contractors, and that's fine probably until you get to about 50 people and then it starts to get a bit unwieldy. So we converted everyone to employees. We scaled very quickly to about, I think we've got about 200 people now, give or take, as part of the legacy Scythe business. And so, you know, it really worked for me at the time. Instinctively, it was a good deal, and it was a good deal at Transpire.
So it's a really big step up for you as a business. It gave you that real next level stuff.
Yeah, and I'd probably say, like, instinctively, and also from my experience, I would say most partnerships or collaborations don't work very well. Like, they sound good. The execution is challenging. But the two guys that I dealt with as part of the... three guys I did the deal with, actually, were the guy called Tom Shelford, who's a partner at Baymark Capital, who the private equity group that owned LOD. And Simon Harper, who's the founder of LOD, and Tom Hartley, who was the CEO of LOD. And I think, you know, they're nice people, they're serious people, which I think is important. So, you know, I got the feeling that they were willing to stand by their word and they weren't juicing the deal for me. As for anyone who knows them, they're just not, none of those people are like that. They're stand up guys. And then I think as well, their approach to integration was sensible, which was really, do you, you know, have what you want, but we're not going to try and force you to do anything. And it just worked really well because then we could pick and choose what we want. So we could take the things that were helpful. And yeah, kind of say, okay, thanks, but no thanks for the things that, it's, say for example, I think, yeah, you know, we took the IT back office, we took the marketing, we shared sales opportunities. They were all helpful. We tried to share the legal support and that just didn't work for us because we're a different kind of company. So we just said, okay, we'll actually get back to doing that ourselves. And it worked really well. And I think most such arrangements, most people would not, they'd either not take it seriously and it would just be one of those things that sounds nice but never happens, or
yeah,
you know, they would probably be more strict about saying you've got to have this. So you know, it just worked really well for me.
Okay, and I think that actually that feeds into the how-to that you're going to talk us through, and that's about, you know, the team that got you here maybe isn't the team that takes you there. So over to you, your how-to.
See, I think that's a really important point. See, when I started the business, which was a conceptual idea. So I think I said earlier, I had a passion, but no plan. So you're really quite reliant on, you know, literally you could count on two hands the number of people that were into this subject matter when I started the business. And shared my passion. So they came along on the journey with me at the start. And then later, I was actually quite reliant on hiring people because as an in-house lawyer, you don't have an extensive network of professionals in different disciplines. So I was quite reliant on hiring people I knew or ex-colleagues. And, you know, you can look through the history of the business, so it's little. I don't actually really regret any of hiring any of those people because for the time, the business, you know, the time and the business's evolution back then, they were the right people and every single one of them pushed the business forward. But the thing that I think is really challenging, and it took me a while to get to grips with, and even now I'm probably still coping with, is the fact that as the business grows, people do outlive their usefulness, and you know, the person, the right sales guy for a 1 million turnover 20 person business is almost certainly not going to be the right salesperson I think the business I'm running now is 40 to 50 million. It's a completely different discipline that's required. And actually looking back, there are not that many people left from the kind of original 20. I can go through them really, but we've got a couple of kind of grey-haired experts who were experts when I hired them, and they're still experts, and they've never done anything else other than be experts. So And then I've actually got a guy called Jamie Goldrich. He lives in Leeds, and he joined me. He had done some work experience with me while I was at Asda, but I'd forgotten who he was, to be honest. And he messaged me on LinkedIn and said, look, I've seen what you're doing. I'm quite keen to join. So he joined us when he was probably no more than, I think he was 18, maybe even 17 when he joined us. He's 26 now, so. And he's actually, he just kind of grown with the business. But, you know, a lot of good people who I'm mostly still friends with. I must admit, some of them I'm no longer on the Christmas card list, or the Hanukkah card list in some cases. But and I think you've just got to be. I think my biggest piece of advice, and this is not an original Maiden concept, is think of your business like a team, rather than like a family. So it's a sports team, not a family. So it's not the case that, you know, the kind of, it's not the case that you are responsible for someone as if they are a cousin or a brother or whatever. You're not. And you should always be thinking about, I think you owe it to your other colleagues. To make sure that you're improving your team when the opportunity becomes available. And that this is a big point for me, because if I had one regret, it's that as I transitioned from thinking about the team as a family to thinking about the employees as a family to thinking about them as a team, it's probably the case that I protected certain employees for too long, even though our other colleagues knew that they clearly weren't up to it. And it was dispiriting for those other colleagues to have to deal with a protected person, and it made me look weak, which, as you know, Phil, is probably the last thing you want to do as a leader, is look weak.
I had exactly the same situation in my business, where it was actually employee number one, and we held on to him for too long. And part of it was the fear of, oh, the whole business will collapse if he goes. And it got to the point where you probably come across the term, you know, he became the brilliant jerk and had to go. And it's something I speak to clients about now. And it's tough. It's one of those things, but you owe it to the business, but you also, as you've just said, you owe it more to the rest of the team, because they can see what's going on and they're going, hang on a minute, why is he not doing something about this? It's one of those tough jobs as the business grows to see who fits where we're going to go next. So let's take the business pretty much up to date. August last year, you sold. Talk us through that.
I have to be a little bit careful, because I signed a lot of NDAs in the past 18 months. But essentially, we were given the opportunity to participate in a process that LOD were running to sell the two businesses as a group. We ran a, Pointer Rothschilds ran a process. Anyone who sold the business will be familiar with how that works. Received a lot of interest. Pretty tough time to sell a business while interest rates are so high. We got there in the end. I'll admit, you know, to our slight surprise, it was a trade buyer. So Consilio, a massive US alternative legal service provider specializing in e-discovery. I think, you know, over $1 billion turnover business, a massive business. It was just the right deal for us at the time, really. I felt like it was a good point. I think talked about scale earlier, but I also think it's, you know, we compete against PwC, Accenture, Deloitte, you know, EY, and we probably had two challenges. One was that, you know, most people hadn't heard of us. So people in the industry had heard of us and people with an interest in the industry, but it was often the case that we were in an RFP scenario. We were immediately on the back foot, by the fact that, you know, the brand recognition versus say Deloitte is non-existent. So if the person hadn't heard of us. And then the second point was, although we'd actually had quite a lot of success in the US by our standards. So I think, you know, US business was responsible for, let's say, I don't know the exact numbers, but at a guess, 30% of our turnover went at the point of the acquisition. But yeah, that's tiny by US standards, absolutely tiny. And say, I think for the further growth of the business, we'd really have to compete in the US. So actually becoming part of Consilio really worked for us. I've taken over leadership of their equivalent business. So as I said earlier, I'm now running a team of about 350 people. It's probably the biggest team of legal tech experts out there. So I feel quite a lot of responsibility. And I've spent, it's quite funny actually, because one of my team members said to me the other day, we're not quite sure what you've been doing for the last 6 months, Alistair. But as you can imagine, there's a hell of a lot of work that goes into integrating into a business like this, you know, from particularly when, you know, we're global, so we've got people in Buenos Aires, we've got people all over India. I was out in Cape Town last week. You know, there's so much complexity from a geographical perspective in integrating the businesses. And it's not just the technical things like GP transferring people over and you know, making sure that employment conditions line up in the right way, but also probably even more so from a change management perspective. How do you go from being, you know, an entrepreneurial business where the senior leadership team were all shareholders in the company, you know, to being part of a larger organization where they're not? And you know, that's quite different for people. And how do you motivate those people on a ongoing basis? And then you take that through, you know, the 200 people that we've had. You know, there's a lot of work to do. Now, I have to say, seems to be going really well, so no one's left yet.
Yeah, I'll remind you in a year's time that you said that when it all falls apart.
Yeah. So it's great, and you know, some challenge. I'll be straight up. There are some challenges about. I mean, I found it quite funny. I had sent a mea culpa email the other day about infringing a load of internal governance rules where certain people's approval was required, and I had no idea. I'm used to just basically doing what I want when I want. And there are other things as well about, you know, I think when you run your own business, if you want to sponsor the local, you know, girls hockey team or whatever, you can do it. And that's a little bit chatter, you know, particularly where you've had long-term relationships with local organizations and you can't do that anymore. That, you know, takes a bit of getting used to. But I think someone said to me right at the start of the integration, and the business that has acquired us has actually made 80 acquisitions in the last 10 years, to give you an idea.
Wow.
So they, you know, they've got the t-shirt on this, and they're a nice bunch of people. And I think the CEO said right at the start, look, feathers will be ruffled, but you should just assume in good intentions. And I think that's a really good way of thinking about it. And they've certainly been true to that. So I think most things actually, even if they're annoying, if you let it settle down, you kind of understand.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting, but to be honest, I think you can in terms of the future, I think you can overthink it and overanalyze it. And I've got a big job to do that's going to consume me for at least the next couple of years. I'm enjoying it. I'll just play. I'm just going to play. I presume at a certain point in time, they'll say, thanks for everything. Here's your carriage clock or whatever. Yeah. But for now, it seems to be getting pretty well.
So very, very quick last question then. And you might have to be careful what the answer is here. Which do you prefer? The sort of startup entrepreneur or the 300 team manager in a billion plus turnover business?
It's a really difficult question, Phil, because I'm at a totally different point in my life now. I didn't used to be able to sleep, for example. I couldn't sleep because I'd wake up in the morning and I'd be like, oh my God, my 10 million things to do. If I don't do them, then this client will move on. Whereas, now, I mean, don't get me wrong, it still hurts, but if a client moves on, you'll probably get another client and maybe the deal will be even bigger. So it's a very different, feeling. I kind of reached a piece with it, and I'm enjoying that for a period. And I think, I think it's really interesting when you think about, some of the people that we both know who are like hyper energetic and are on that treadmill constantly. And I worry about the impact that has from a mental and physical perspective. Like it's really just from a practical perspective. I mean, I'm not quite yet there yet, but I was laughing that basically since I started the business, pretty much from the day I started the business, I've been overweight for about 8 years. Not much, but a little bit overweight. A little bit to quite a bit. Never really bad, but overweight. And so I sold in August, and I think I'm now at literally a few pounds from not being overweight. And I'm like, I haven't really done anything. I'm just less stressed, basically. So may be a period of, I do think I've got another business in me, definitely. Like, I'd like to do it again.
Right. Yeah,
I'd like to do it again, but obviously, having effectively had two capital realization moments already within a few years. Next time I start a business, first of all, we'll have an IT guy from the start. Secondly, I'll probably be able to sleep at night, even if things go badly. So, I think that's quite different stage in life. So. It was amazing. I would not swap experience. I would not swap the experience for anything.
Yeah, it is. It is a having done the same journey, but obviously with a lot less zeros. I totally agree, Alistair. It's been absolutely fascinating listening to the story. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Phil. It's been great.
Thanks for listening to this episode. I hope you found it interesting, inspiring, and of use. To make sure you don't miss out on any future episodes, please subscribe to the show. Go on, do it now. Do it now before you go off and do something else. Thank you, much appreciated. Oh, and don't forget our fair deal. See you next week.